Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt, and let's give the people what they want. That is Major League Baseball lockout conversation, Stephen. They love it.
The kids love it, don't they? The kids love it.
Yeah, they do. No, they don't. I don't love it either. I want it to be over. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the aspect of it that I want to talk most about is like the likelihood that Monday's counterproposal from the players to the owners is perhaps a step towards a resolution here. It wasn't. There were not great indications after the first proposal since the lockout from the owners that the players were like, "Ooh, okay, now we got something." If that doesn't happen, if we don't get more positive news after Monday, like I'm really going to have a hard time seeing at least spring training not being significantly impacted by this labor stoppage. And I might start thinking about, yeah, the beginning of the regular season being impacted. I'm also struck by everybody analyzing this from a neutral perspective, as neutral as they can be, and we all know everybody has their biases, but the numbers do not lie. Major League Baseball, the profits continue to go up. The money into baseball continues to go up, and payrolls are down. They were down 4%. They're at the same level as they were in 2015. 2021 was the same level of pay for the players as it was 6 years prior. Feels clearly that the players need some sort of a win here. Again, the issues are not massive, but feels like Monday is kind of a big day for this.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a good day, just for
great
the record.
Thank you.
You know, we are still kind of in the skirmish phase of this, the phony war to some degree, but it's interesting, you know. We all kind of acknowledge the inevitability of the December 1st lockout because that's the game owners play with players in collective bargaining now. That's, you know, you lock out preemptively because you don't want players going on strike in the middle of a season. And it's almost like, yeah, it's kind of de rigueur, right? Like, okay, but you know, it felt like I think we all were kind of saying, well, what's the issue here, right? Like, this isn't about imposing a salary cap or what, like, trying to beat the reserve clause or something. What's the great issue of principle here? Surely they will go into the system and adjust it here and adjust it there, and little give on one side, little take on the other, and there'll be lots of shots fired across the bow in the meantime. But you know, they won't do anything over Christmas, and then they'll work to, then the deadline will approach, or sort of deadlines will approach, and as it gets closer and closer, they will be forced to come up with something, because neither side is going to be willing to risk a season and risk the business that's still in the middle of a pandemic, and you know, just for a whole bunch of reasons that's a bad idea for everyone. So I think that's where we were in the fall. Mm-hmm. And then the owners came back with their first post-Christmas proposal, which didn't really move the needle at all. The players are going to, as you say, are going to counter next week. But I just, you know, the stuff you read, I just read Evan Drolich's piece, most recent piece on The Athletic, and he's done some really good work, as he tends to, covering this particular labor dispute. And it's not encouraging, I got to say, because it feels... You know, it feels like this is turning into a bit of a test of wills, that the owners are going to kind of dare the players to keep going, you know, dare the players. The players are trying to get something. The players got, you know, shafted in the last negotiation. They are trying to get something back. The membership is demanding that the union get a better deal this time. So there are pressures on their union leadership. And I think the owners are kind of playing chicken with it here and saying, okay, you know, sure, you guys are going to be militant. You know, you got a player group that's none of these guys have ever lived through a work stoppage. None of them have ever missed games for a labor dispute. You know, they're not part of that generation of players that were so tuned into the union when the union was undefeated back in the day. Let's see how much resolve you have. And when it turns into that, rather than kind of reasonable people trying to slice the pie, that's when things go haywire. Look, like when the NHL lost a season over the league's desire to impose a cap, there was a huge issue on the table there. But, you know, part of what went haywire was, you know, that the leadership on both sides, it became kind of a, you know, a, test of their manhood. You know, like, it was there was a personal element to that, and eventually, the Bob Goodenow, the leader of the union, was destroyed. That's how that one ended, with the destruction of Bob Goodenow by his own people, like a Knight of the Long Knives. That the owners and the league certainly, they worked behind the scenes and they worked to undermine him, and they end ran him to get directly to players, and they did all kinds of stuff. And eventually his own people turned on him. Part of the reason why that thing lasted as long as it did and was as destructive as it was about personalities.
Yeah.
And I wonder about this one now, Ben, it's a legacy moment for Rob Manfred, and it might not be a good one.
Well, and okay, so that is really scary, what you're talking about. But yeah, I get it. Like, the differences between the NHL labor dispute and the lost season and this one was that was a game changer. It was the salary cap. Yep. They changed the entire framework of how that league operates. No such thing is happening here. But the reason they were able to break the union, which they did, I mean, the leadership was done and they had, it crumbled. The union crumbled. It's because they lost an entire year of checks. Now, does that type of pressure exist without actually missing regular season games? Because the players, again, do not get paid for any part of spring training. They get like a per diem or something. But the checks only start coming after game one of the regular season. So if you are talking about, hey, how much are you willing to risk, and how steadfast are you in your belief that you can come out on top? Like, that only comes when, I think, when players, for the first time, as you mentioned, in their professional lives, stare down the barrel of every 2 weeks nothing appearing in their bank accounts.
You are correct. The short answer is unless they're really soft.
Sheldon Keefe, yeah. Very good.
There, yes, you would think that it would, until it starts to affect their bank accounts, that what's going to keep them awake at night, right? Like, it's all pretend until that happens. But if that's true, like, again, if that's what we're talking about here, which is, let's test the player's will and let's see how that tough this union is. And remember, this is the same ownership group and the same commissioner who, in 2020, when, everybody thought, well, there's going to be a reasonable solution here to resume play, and they're going to agree on a schedule and try and max out to the benefit for everybody, because Lord knows the world's going down the toilet. And it's desperate times. And what happened? The owners ended up imposing. They imposed a schedule on the players. They just said, no, we have the power to do this. The hell with you. So that's the signature moment right now for this commissioner and this group of owners. Mm-hmm. What's that tell you?
It's not good, and it's reason why. I mean, if I was going to take the optimistic viewpoint, is that sitting here today on whatever day it is, March 111th, 2050, whatever it is, January 21st, 2022, that. I didn't expect necessarily to be in a different spot. Like, I didn't expect this all to have been neatly and packed away and finished without any anxiety. I expected anxiety. So at this point in the proceedings, this is not – I can just speak personally. I'm not surprised by this. I do tend to have a pessimistic view of professional sports, labor negotiations, and why not. Considering what the last 20 years have told us. So this isn't necessarily surprising to me, Stephen. And again, we're not at February yet, and I guess Monday will tell us a lot. The indications are bad, but that also might be part of the posturing thing too, right? Like, everything that's being reported, all the temperature checks from both sides, they're sending us indications that things aren't going well to maybe run some of this through the media to ratchet up the pressure on the other side. So maybe that's part of it.
Hope so. And it's you're not wrong. Like, it's entirely possible. Number one, you're absolutely right that what's the date today? January 21st. I didn't think we would have a deal by the baseball would have a deal by January 21st, or even close to it.
No.
And I thought we would be in the lobbing bombs at each other phase, which we still are. And so, in terms of the calendar, we're exactly where I would have anticipated. And you're right. Sometimes this, you know, the, oh man, this is going to be really bad stuff that's coming out from behind closed doors. That can be tactical as well. Mm-hmm. But I'm, yeah, I, again, there's a solution here. And I know we've had, you know, different people on saying, you know, here's the path to a deal. But I think, you know, outside of the fine points, the path to a deal is for the owners to give a bit in terms of, you know, players getting compensated earlier in their careers, in terms of lightening up the luxury tax, the competitive balance tax, whatever you want to call it, so that it acts a little less like a cap. Taking off some of the restraints on free agency, just giving a few, and then, you know, in return for an expanded playoff and universal DH and some of the stuff that they want, you know, and the players would then have a win because the economic system would shift a bit and the owners would get some things back and give a little, which, in the, again, the last negotiation didn't give anything. Mm-hmm. But it just doesn't feel like that right now, Ben. You know, like, that's what reasonable people would do here.
Yeah.
That's what reasonable people would do, but it doesn't. Just it, I hope that yes, these are not harbingers of doom, that it's just the darkness before the dawn, etc. Cliches abound, but I would recommend reading Evan's piece and then pouring yourself a stiff drink if you're a Blue Jays fan.
Okay. Or reverse order. Okay. Speaking of the dawn, I think the dawn of the robo-ump is upon us. I don't think it's going to happen this season. The commissioner actually does have the power to unilaterally just impose new rule changes. I think he needs to give the players a year leeway to do that. I don't think rule changes are going to be anywhere near the top of the priority list when it comes to these conversations between the league and the union. And for that reason, I think as soon as they come to a conclusion, they're going to just try and get out on the field as quickly as possible. So I don't think any of the massive Theo Epstein led rule changes are going to happen in 2022, at least in Major League Baseball. But they're coming to AAA. Like, that's happening. That there's about 10 to 15 AAA ballparks that will now employ this robo-ump technology, which had a pretty successful year and a half in the Atlantic League. Now, it was very different, and we've talked to a couple of different people who have seen it in action in that league, where, yeah, breaking balls can look a little weird, where, you know, if you have a curveball that ends up in the dirt and the catcher has to block it, but it just clips the front of the strike zone, that's a strike in robo-ump world. I was also struck by the fact that the Major League Baseball Umpires Association has already signed something with Major League Baseball that they will... they won't fight this, like, when it starts to happen, because it won't cost them jobs. It's going to be the greatest job in the world to be a home plate umpire in Major League Baseball, where you're just you're being told exactly what the correct call is. And yes, you have, I guess, safe out, but even that, you have instant replay. This is going to I'm wagering that we have robot umpires in 2023 in Major League Baseball, Steven.
Yeah, it's you know, because it's as you described it, right? It's not like I'm right that there are no lines people calling the Australian Open now, right? That it's entirely, is it without lines people now?
I didn't even notice. Anyway, assumed there were people.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I saw it wrong. But we know the technologies that technology exists in tennis.
Yes,
it's made, you know, it's made lines people. They get to shout, but if they're wrong, it's, mm-hmm. you understand very quickly when they're wrong. If it's used to kind of like, it'd be interesting if the guy standing behind the plate with the mask and the, you know, and the chest protector is just there for what, decoration. I guess you couldn't just make them go away completely. I guess there are things that they would have to do on the field, but I'm trying to think what those would be. You know, rules, and there are rulings they would have to make in the moment. But look, I'll be interested to see it in AAA. I hope I get a chance to see it. Because sometimes these things, you know, like I think it was like the first time I saw a pitch clock game in the minors. And I had always thought, boy, that'll be the worst thing in the world, because everybody's going to be staring up at this pitch clock counting down. You don't even notice it. You know, it just becomes background very quickly. And I think this would be the same thing. And it would, you know, maybe take away, it'll take away some of the challenges of being an umpire, which are like, I couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. It's hard to do.
Joe West couldn't do it.
Yeah, but maybe it'll take away the Joe Westiness of some of these guys, right? Like, they won't sit back there and act like they're God, which I think that would be a plus for baseball. Like, I have no fondness for, sideshow umpiring. I have none. They're not part of the entertainment value in the game. They're not.
I will say the one thing that I enjoy about that aspect of umpiring is the dust up between a manager and an umpire. You still see it occasionally, but I like a guy throwing his hat, and I like a kick in the dirt and the occasional nose to nose. But I guess that'll still exist because there'll be other calls that are judgment calls. It's the 11-year anniversary, which we don't necessarily celebrate the 11th year of something. But you know what? I do feel like there's a topic here that's underserved. 11 years ago today, the Toronto Blue Jays traded Vernon Wells in that untradeable contract, retaining zero of the dollars to the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim for Mike Napoli and Juan Rivera. And then, of course, they turned around and traded Mike Napoli to Texas for Frank Francisco. And maybe we'll get into that aspect of the trade as well. But the Vernon Wells part is I don't know, confusing to me a little bit because the contract was not great. It was a 7-year, $126 million deal for a guy who put up top 10 MVP numbers in 2003 and was again a top 30 guy in the MVP race in 2006. He was a very good Blue Jay. He committed to staying in Toronto and performed below his career averages, and injuries were a part of that. He broke his wrist in the final years of his Blue Jays career. But Vernon Wells, like, you bring up the name Vernon Wells to maybe a generic Blue Jays fan, and it's there's not a disdain, but he's viewed as maybe like a punchline in Blue Jays history. This is one of the better Blue Jays in the history of the franchise.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That he was a very good player, bordering on great for a few years, who, as you say, committed to the organization, and the organization committed to him. You know, the symbolism of that was important in that moment too. You know, we're going to hold on to our own guy. And again, if you're going to look through the history of the Jays between the World Series wins in that moment, you know, some pretty good people came and went, in the organization over those years. So it mattered at the moment. And then, you know, he just didn't go anywhere from there, and he plateaued. But, you know, Vernon Wells is a good number one, really good dude. Like, not like Alex Rios, who also signed a very lucrative contract, and they ended up having to release him. But, you know, Vernon's a great guy, you know, good citizen, good part of the team. It's not like he didn't try. He was what he was, and it's not, Ben, like, it's one of those things that it goes through sport. You know, now in the era of sport where we talk about contracts and, you know, whether guys are living up to them, and, you know, we report all those numbers and, you know, kind of report on that like we report on the games. It's not, but, it takes two people to sign a contract like that, right? Somebody really, like the Blue Jays, without a gun to their head, offered him that money and he accepted it. And so how is he the bad guy? You know, like, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it doesn't work out. You know, it's not sometimes careers are unpredictable. They don't just keep going up and up and up and up. And, you know, but Vernon didn't do anything wrong. And, you know, he's looking after his family, and he did exactly what he should have done. No Blue Jays fan should hold any kind of a grudge against him. He's, you know, he is who he is.
Yeah, and in his final season with the Blue Jays in 2010, he was an all-star, and he OPS'd 847, played 157 games, had 31 homers, and then his career really did start to decline significantly when he got to L.A., and then last season in New York with the Yankees. The Mike Napoli part of it is, it's kind of under-discussed because he was never a Blue Jay. Like, they flipped him. I feel like it was almost immediately for Frank Francisco, who was a very forgettable Blue Jay reliever. I think his career will most be remembered for what? Throwing the chair in the brawl in Texas?
I think that's
remember
correct.
That?
Yes, that is right. Yeah. Yes. Well, I've forgotten that, but you're right.
Yeah. That's, and having two similar names, Frank. But yeah, Mike Napoli was really good. Like, yes, he had a, he was like, that was the one that got away. And yeah, okay, he wasn't a catcher, and maybe they looked too much at his defensive inability, but that guy could hit.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And
they should have held on to him.
They should have held on to him. But, you know, this, look, still moving that, you know, moving Vernon when they did, getting somebody to take all of the money. You know, that's a pretty good bit of general managing, I guess. You know, you're supposed to know your guys better than anybody else knows them. You know, again, I think, as I recall, part of it had to do with kind of the larger circumstances of the franchise at that point. So, you know, maybe it wasn't all just, you know, general managerial genius, but it, the Napoli part aside, it did work out for the Jays because they didn't have to pay Vernon through those last years of his career when, as you say, he went into a pretty precipitous decline.
Yes, he did. All right, it's the best weekend of football on the entire calendar. Although it was pointed out that quite often we think these games are super close, and a bunch of them will be. But yeah, the spread between winners and losers over the last couple of years has been double digits on average. I think we're all excited about the Sunday nighter, which we already went over, a rematch of the AFC Championship game. Let's look at the other three games. Before I get to those, though, there's a couple of ridiculous stats. Well, this one in particular, and there's so many Tom Brady stats that it's, yeah, and perhaps this won't blow people away, but yeah, Tom Brady is older than the head coaches of the other three remaining NFC playoff teams. Matt LaFleur, Kyle Shanahan, both 42. Sean McVay turns 36, and of course Brady is 44. Maybe let's start with that one, Stephen, because the Bucs are very banged up, and also without Antonio Brown, who I guess was banged up according to him. But that offensive line is in rough shape now. The a couple of the linemen that were injured last week are questionable and probably will play, but Chris Godwin's been out for the season. Leonard Fournette is, I think, questionable for this weekend as well. And then on the other side, you got this Rams team that has no first-round picks from now until the rest of time. And somehow, with all the cap constraints, we're able to add mid-season Odell Beckham Jr. and Von Miller. Like, every season that goes by without them appearing in and winning a Super Bowl is a nightmare. And Tom Brady, once again, is playing with house money. He's the defending Super Bowl champion at 44.
It is, you know, if the Rams show up and are the sum of their parts, and Matthew Stafford throws to the guys in the right uniforms, they should win, you know, because, and again, what I'm assuming there is that Aaron Donald and company mm-hmm. can make Tom Brady uncomfortable with just a four-man rush. That, you know, if you have to sell out against Tom Brady, he'll kill you, right? So, but you know, if ever a defensive line should be capable of doing that, it's their defensive line, right? And Aaron Donald's been doing, you know, arguably the best player in the league. So, and as you say, the Tampa offensive line's a bit chewed up too. So, if those guys can make Tom Brady uncomfortable, and if Matthew Stafford doesn't make mistakes and throws to Cooper Kupp and throws to Odell Beckham, and they got two pretty good running backs, the Rams, you know, probably should win that game. But anything, you know, but if Tom Brady is comfortable in the pocket, I don't, you know, we've seen him work. Look, I saw him work with New England with not a whole lot, aside from Gronk. And you know, look what he did. He had Randy Moss for 1 year, but other than that, look at the guys he made into really good receivers. Like you don't want, if all things being equal, Tom Brady will beat you. So you have to make things not equal from the Rams' point of view. And I think they've got the guys to do it. It's just, if you've been watching them all year, you have no idea what team's going to show up. And I think at the end of the first quarter, you're probably going to know.
Yeah, well, and Matthew Stafford does have now a playoff victory, so good for him. Tom Brady has many more than one. But it's a really interesting game from a narrative perspective, as is Niners in Lambeau to play the Packers. Aaron Rodgers 0-3 in playoff games against the Niners in his career. His last one, I mean, in this era, against Kyle Shanahan was an absolute beatdown. Like, they were never in it. And you got to feel, at least I do, like Kyle Shanahan has the mental edge over his pal Matt LaFleur. Can Jimmy G keep away from that back-breaking interception? Will he be required to pass it very much at all? Like, the Packers really struggle to stop the run, and the Niners have this incredible running game. I really, man, especially if the Niners get out to a lead in this game, it could be very difficult for Green Bay to come back, I feel like.
I think that's the key, right? That's one of the keys, right? Is that, yeah, if San Francisco can play. Now, they played from ahead. They played ahead against Dallas and still almost blew it.
Yep.
Because Garoppolo fell apart in the fourth quarter. So you don't want to ask him to do too much. I haven't looked at the weather forecast. Is it going to be frozen tundra-ish? I haven't looked. But
it is late January in Green Bay. So I feel like you can bank on that.
Run the ball. Really good defense. You know, again, make Aaron Rodgers uncomfortable. He's still going to get his. Eat some clock. Get ahead. Yeah, all of that. That's the formula for San Francisco winning. But if Garoppolo has to, like, Jimmy Garoppolo's not going to win the game for you. You know, he might not lose it for you. That would be that's kind of what you're shooting for here. But I don't, if you have to, you know, if it's the fourth quarter and you're down by six and there's 3 minutes left, he's not the guy I necessarily want, you know, with my playoff fate in his hands. So, yeah, I think our pal from Buffalo referred to him as the worst quarterback remaining, you know, in the playoffs. I think, you know, is he worse than Ryan Tannehill? But he is.
Dude. Yeah.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he is. And he's had a fourth quarter lead in a Super Bowl. But it doesn't matter. Yeah, he absolutely is that. And yeah, I don't know. This could of course also be Aaron Rodgers' final game with that Packers team, and especially if they lose this one, you got to feel like the odds favor a departure from Green Bay for Aaron Rodgers. All right, and then finally, Derrick Henry officially activated today. We knew that was coming. He was practicing basically all week for the Titans. This is kind of the forgotten game of the weekend, and I get it, right? Like, yeah, the Titans are kind of viewed as this paper tiger top seed in the AFC, despite the fact that, you know, they beat the Bills and the Chiefs, and they've been outstanding, and they've been banged up all season long, and had this bye week to actually, you know, perhaps the bye week didn't benefit anybody more than that Titans team, who allow them to get Derrick Henry back, allow themselves to get healthy, and the Bengals are this team that should just be happy to be here, first time in the Joe Burrow era being into the playoffs. But yeah, they had a pretty big win over the Chiefs late in the season. Like, yeah, I wouldn't totally write off either team in the AFC, and I think it would be, I mean, we really do, you can do your paper tiger stuff on the Titans, I guess, if they lose this game, but yeah, a rematch against the Bills or Chiefs would be pretty tantalizing.
Yeah, I love Joe Burrow. I think he's awesome, and he's going to be, you know, as long as his knee holds up, he's going to be awesome for a long time with Jamar Chase. Like, that's a great combination. They're fun to watch. Yeah, I loved him when he was at LSU. Both of them when they were at LSU, right? They're great. I don't know that if the Cincinnati defense is good enough to, you know, like, it's, you know what, you know what the Titans are going to do. You know, they're going to run the ball, and then they're going to run play action off it. That's what they do. But Vrabel's a great game coach, in game coach. You know, yeah, I think there's a lot of people did the look at the point differential, the worst first point differential for any one seed in the history of this playoff format or whatever. I don't think this is where they lose. I don't think this is the game they lose. Now, the next one, you know, against either the Chiefs or Buffalo, that's an interesting style matchup. You know, a style matchup that didn't play to the Bills' advantage. But, I kind of like Tennessee in this game. You know, might not be pretty, but I actually like Tennessee in this game.
Yeah. It was great to get the amount of football we did in Wild Card Weekend, but I would say that the quality of play and there was a couple of legendary games. I mean, the Cowboys 49ers played a pretty great game, and you know what, to start the weekend, Bengals Raiders was pretty good too. But yeah, I mean, this is what we live for. If you've watched football the entire season, like, these are spectacular. I don't know if you could ask for four better matchups.
No, it's fantastic, and you're right. It is the best football weekend of the year, and it starts to. This is the when I start, in not even maybe more so maybe in locked in the house pandemic times. But you start to dread that week after Super Bowl, don't you? Right when football football goes away, and what am I?
Well,
oh my God!
Normally,
I have a family.
Or you think like 2 weeks until pitchers and catchers. Except, yeah, probably not though.
Yeah, so that might be a tricky emotional stretch for us. We might want to prep people for that. We're available. We'll be available for counseling that week.
I'm going to choose to live in the moment. All right, when we come back, If the playoffs started right now in the National Hockey League, there'd only be one Canadian team in there, and that would be the Toronto Maple Leafs. Other six on the outside looking in. Now, granted, the Flames and the Jets are just on the outside in the West and have lots of games in hand, but been a disappointing season so far for the Canadian franchises. Let's talk to Damian Cox, author of A League of Our Own, celebrating the Canadian division next as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And if you're like me, you went back and forth on how fun it was to watch all the Canadian teams play in that Canadian division last year. Yes, it would have been great to have fans, that goes without saying. But yeah, seeing the Canadian teams a lot was a lot by the end of it, but at least it was, you were guaranteed to see some of them in the playoffs, four of them. At this point in the proceedings, only one Canadian team would be in the postseason picture at the moment. Perhaps that changes, but yeah, it's been a down year for the Canadian franchises outside of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Let's talk to Damian Cox, author of A League of Our Own, celebrating the Canadian division, who joins us on the line right now. How's it going, Damian?
Good, guys. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, this feels bad. This feels like you really have to squint to think about bright futures for some of these franchises north of the border.
Yeah, you feel like, as you were saying, can we petition Bettman? Can we have our division back again? It was kind of nice while it lasted for a lot of reasons. And, you know, early this season, the suggestions that the Canadian teams hadn't been as strong as their American counterparts last year looked like that wasn't the case, because a number of the Canadian teams, Edmonton, Calgary, were doing really well along with the Maple Leafs. But only the Maple Leafs have been able to keep their head above water ever since then. And, you know, Winnipeg, Paul Maurice moved on. They're kind of an uncertain team right now. They're a little hard to figure out. Things have gone downhill in Alberta. So if you view things through that lens of how the Canadian teams are doing right now, it's not like quite like 2016 where all seven teams missed the playoffs, but it's not looking great right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's well, it's probably going to be a little better than it is now, right? Like there are a lot of games lost there. You know, I think Calgary's probably still a playoff team. You know, Vancouver's come back to life under Boudreau a bit and not looking as dreadful as they did at the beginning of the season, you know. But then we see, you know, the flip side of that is, you know, Edmonton have fallen off a cliff. So it's a less pretty picture than I think we would have imagined at the beginning of this year. You know, even post Canadian division, again, I think there was a sense that you had one legitimate Stanley Cup contender in the group in Toronto, and then you had Edmonton that, you know, finally they're going to have to figure it out eventually, you know, with the refrain of the last decade plus, that if you've got, you know, two of the best players in the league, surely you eventually will be good. But it's you know, and again, I guess the great irony is that the team from the sad sack Canadian division that actually went to the Stanley Cup Finals last year is arguably the worst team in hockey right now.
Yeah, and that's, I don't think that's ever a good thing for the NHL when the Montreal Canadiens are that bad. Just like it's never a good thing for the NHL when the Toronto Maple Leafs are that bad. The Leaf fans have got used to a little bit more than Montreal fans. The weird thing, guys, is that, like, I don't know how you feel about this season, but with COVID and all the postponements and now back to fans not in the building, like, it feels like the season is kind of... And I know our old friend Cam Cole was talking about this on Twitter a little while ago. Like, it just doesn't seem like this season has the context that we're used to. Like, it's really hard to judge. You know, the Leafs right now are in third place in their division behind Tampa and Florida, but they have a bunch of games in hand. And like, they've got to make up 10 games over the next couple of months. So how's that going to impact them, their personnel? You know, what if they run into injuries? And it just seems like all the stars of the Canadian teams, except for probably Austin Matthews, are really not performing the way they'd hoped. I mean, Vancouver hoped for more, a big season from Elias Pettersson. That's not happening. McDavid and Draisaitl may have the numbers in Vancouver or in Edmonton, but that team's not going over. And you can go through each of the teams. So, I don't know. it looks like everybody's struggling, but it's really hard to find that context because of all the postponed games, all the players on COVID, to really understand what's going on with some of these teams.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's a good point.
No, for sure. And, I mean, we're still 2 months away from the trade deadline. So, yeah, yeah. That whole Elliott Friedman American Thanksgiving thing where, you know, you got to be in a playoff spot or in and around one by then probably yeah. doesn't hold water this year. It's definitely a weird year. Let's talk about the local team, though, for a second here, Damian, because we spent some time talking about how Sheldon Keefe called his team soft after blowing yeah. that lead at MSG the other day, and then immediately today in his media availability before any questions were even asked, clarified, I guess, his comments, didn't apologize for them, but felt like he needed to build off of that conversation, perhaps relieve some of the pressure that he put on his team. What do you make of a comment like that in the middle of this season that has been generally very positive for this Leafs team, and they're dealing with a bunch of injuries right now? What do you think happened there?
I think he got pissed. Is what I think. I think he got mad looking at them in New York, and they just basically rolled over in that game. While the Rangers, who can be a kind of a physical team, sort of just pushed them around a little bit. So I think that annoyed him. If you know the kind of player Sheldon Keefe was at his best, you know, he was a feisty guy, a little guy who always fought through it. So I think he was annoyed as heck. I do find it interesting in Toronto how coaches are held to different standards with what they say. I mean, he also said in that after that game, you know, Jack Campbell, he's not been quite the goalie he was of late that he was early in the season. If Mike Babcock had made either one of those comments, he would have been crucified for, quote-unquote, throwing his team under the bus. But Sheldon Keefe, for reasons that I'm never entirely sure, and maybe it's just a different media environment since, like, we can't get within 20 feet of any of these athletes anymore. It's all Zoom. It's a Zoom world out there. He kind of doesn't get a pass, but it's not headlines everywhere, you know. Keith crucifies team. So, you know, maybe it's a different feel and with a different coach. At some point, though, Keith's going to face a very difficult prospect that he's going to probably have to face Tampa or Florida in the first round of the playoffs,
yep.
which are at least are going to be the underdog in that series. And what if he can't get his team out of the first round again? And I think that maybe he's starting to feel a little bit of the pressure of this whole thing, that a team that looked like it was really, really, really good has been showing some warts over the past week and a half on the road.
Well, I remember, Domo, the week before, the soft comment was after the Arizona game where he said their conditioning wasn't up to snuff. So, yeah. You know, like that, like, so it's kind of, you know, the truth serum, you know, it's, you know, he seems to be actually saying what he thinks. Yeah, it's awesome. You know, how many coaches who've gone up and said, "Well, the boys tried hard tonight, but they didn't," you know, are actually thinking, "Yeah, the guys, you know, they shouldn't have spent that much time out in Vegas, got off the golf course, or you know what, maybe they are kind of soft, and suspected that they were soft in January, and looking ahead to April and going, you know, if they're soft in January, April's not going to be any fun."
This
team is built to win in the playoffs?
You know, I was looking at them again earlier this year, particularly had that bad start, then they really came on and they looked so solid. But I mean, I think you're again staring at the three main guys, Matthews, Marner, and Nylander, and asking that very same question. And they look pretty much the same. Matthews is putting up great numbers. Marner's had a weird season because of COVID and other stuff. Nylander's had a really good season. Mm-hmm. But if they've got to go in against Tampa in the first round, do you like those guys? Are they going to, you know, I hate to use the term battle ready because I don't think military terms have any place in sports, but do you like those guys going head to head against some of those guys the Lightning have for? I mean, ultimately, they're going to have to prove it. But right now, today, it's looking dicey.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the forwards, though. And you know what? Maybe you should, because they didn't lose to the Montreal Canadiens in seven games because the defense was leaky. I mean, Jack Campbell wasn't great, I guess, in game seven. They couldn't score, right? But we do look at this team. I think a lot of people are doing some analyzing of this team, well, and especially during this stretch of a bunch of blown leads, and look at the blue line and what Jake Muzzin was when he was healthy, and then obviously without him, it's a huge loss, and the back end of that blue line. Like, if you were going to go down the list of concerns with this team headed into the playoffs, would it be that the forwards look the same as the ones that couldn't score against, granted, eventual Hall of Famer and Carey Price in seven games last year, or would it be the blue line?
I'm going to go either one of those, and I'm going to go with goaltending. You know what I mean? Look, this team keeps losing in the first round, and every time they play in the first round, they get out goaltending. And Jack Campbell, his numbers are great. He's in the All-Star game. I get all that sort of stuff. But he's been slipping. He has not proven himself in the playoffs. He's not proven himself to be a number one. And you tell me who the backup is. I mean, Peter Mrazek's going to play tomorrow against the Islanders. But until you have a convincing netminder in there that everybody knows is going to be able to take on the other guy, I mean, do you like him against Vasilevsky in the first round? If that's what it comes down to, I mean, now maybe he will be the guy, but that's the question I would want answered. I think if Peter Mrazek can play, 10 games between now and the end of the season and, win 7 of them and really look good, I think that would go a long way to at least making you believe that if Campbell's not quite there, they have an option. Right now, they don't even have an option. It's Jack Campbell or bust.
Yeah, no, and the other thing that they need Mrazek to play those games so they don't run Jack Campbell into the ground between now and the end of the season, which might be a bit of, one of the reasons why he slipped a bit, Dumb. Like, just he's never had this kind of workload in his life.
Even the other night in New York, 4 goals on 22 shots. That's not great. And yeah, Liljegren wasn't very good, and Dermott wasn't very good, and Biega wasn't very good, and Sandin wasn't very good. And that right now is not an NHL defense. But, that's the playoffs, and they're going to – it's going to be really interesting to see what Kyle Dubas comes up with by the trade deadline. If Mrazek can't prove something between now and then, they might have to go out and try to get another goal.
Yeah, that's a tough one when you're spending, $3 million bucks on Mrazek, and he's still under contract for another year as well. And then you have the uncertainty of what you do with Jack Campbell headed into free agency. I do want to talk some tennis with you before we go, Damien, because the highly ranked Canadian men still alive at the Australian Open right now. And I think for a lot of Canadian tennis fans, they've been wondering what it'll look like in the post-Roger, Rafa and Djokovic era, and I guess technically the Nadal era continues because he's still alive in the Australian Open, but he is not quite at the peak of his powers. And I guess at some point the Djokovic era will resume, maybe not. Maybe he won't be allowed to play in any more Grand Slams unless he gets the vax. But are we going to really find out something in the next couple of years here as far as those two, Felix and Chapo, their ability to be the first Canadian man to win a Grand Slam?
Well, yeah. I mean, and the nice thing for those two guys, they're probably going to have, their window is probably the next 8 to 10 years. So they've got lots of time. Assuming they both stay healthy, we might have thought that Milos Raonic would have had that kind of window, but unfortunately injuries have changed everything for him. And you don't know how these guys are going to respond to injuries. But I think the good thing about it for Canadian tennis is there's not just one guy, there's two guys. And they both play power tennis. As much as everybody loved Milos and his saving, I mean, Felix had 28 aces, I think, in his last match. And, Shapovalov is putting up 25 a game. These are guys who are power tennis players. They're superb athletes. And they look as though they should be in the mix. Now, will the doors open up in the post-Rafa, Federer, Djokovic era? Or are we going to see another dominant player, get through there? Could it be a guy like Daniil Medvedev, who Felix may have to play? Or could it be a Zverev? Right. It doesn't look like there's one of those guys that it's going to happen. So, while it feels like you want to see them win now, there's going to be lots of opportunities for these guys, I think, to win a Grand Slam, both of them.
Yeah. Well, they're I think Chapo's got Zverev next, right? So you've got both guys. You're going to run into both of those guys in this tournament potentially. It'd be a hell of a time to win one of those matches.
And if he can get past that, he gets Nadal. I mean, how cool would that be down under? I mean, that would be something. Probably gets Nadal. And, and Felix gets Rublev and then Medvedev, so he gets to take on the Russians. So it's not easy. It's a grand slam. But, boy, you watch these guys, and why wouldn't you get excited? I mean, there's just – with Raonic, it was always big serve, but does he have the rest of the game? These guys have everything. It's whether they can make it happen.
Yep. And if you were going to be optimistic, you would say the Chapo's won two of the last three matches against Zverev. So maybe continues that run of good form against him. Damien, appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this.
Boys, it's been great. Bring back the Canadian division, or it could be another quiet spring.
Yes. Yeah, I would say. Someone that works for the rights holder, yes, definitely. More Canadian teams in the playoffs.
Please. Guaranteed win night. That's what we need.
See you guys.
See ya. Damien Cox, author of A League of Our Own, celebrating the Canadian division. You know what's like? So Milos Raonic, it was a great. I mean, I don't want to talk about him like his career is over, but yeah, his peak is long gone, and he's made a slam final, and he had a great career. You could always, if your bar was winning a Grand Slam, you really had to squint, even in the middle of his great career when he was a top 10 player, to think that he had a real legitimate chance to win a Grand Slam, because he played in the era of the great, like, three guys at different times had claims to be the greatest men's singles tennis player in the history of the sport. Now, their careers, for Federer, might be over entirely. Nadal, okay, he's still alive, and maybe he has a swan song left in him, and Djokovic, who knows, but he's not here now. And the age discrepancy between Nadal and even Djokovic, it's 13 years between him and Shapovalov and Felix. That same excuse will not exist, unless, I guess, Damien's right, like one of these guys does emerge as the next Roger Federer. But, I mean, what a, I guess, run of good luck we would have, that we would live through consecutive eras of the greatest men's tennis players of all time. More than likely, it's going to be a much more flattened field where maybe we should raise our expectation level to those two and talk about them winning one of these things, something that Milos Raonic was unable to do.
I think it's going to be more like the women's game post Serena, or when Serena was hurt, where the number one, number two, number three, number four kind of have shifted around among several players at different times. And, even right now, it's, who's the number one women's player in the world? Well, maybe we'll find out at this tournament. But in that kind of a mix, like, again, I'm not saying that Chapo and Felix Auger-Aliassime couldn't have risen. Let's see how high they can go, because there's a lot of potential there. But I think you're right about Milos, that for everybody in that era, there was a ceiling. And maybe you could get to a Grand Slam final, but you were probably against one of those guys. And then, in his case, his body just betrayed him. He broke down. He didn't age out. It's just that his body wasn't built for it.
No, it wasn't, and hopefully the same doesn't happen to either of these guys. But yeah, so far so good. It's pretty wild to have a couple of top 20 players in the world in this country of almost 40 million, but we do, and they're still alive going into the weekend of the first week of a Grand Slam. All right, Stephen, enjoy the rest of your time in Portland, and safe travels, and we'll see you on Monday.
If they let me back in the country, I will see you on Monday.
All right, fingers crossed. All right, have a great weekend, everybody. This has been The Fan, Drive Time, Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.